This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about belonging with Alex Holmes. Before we get into talking about our wonderful guest, we did do... Why have my settings just come up on Zoom? I didn't request you. Okay, they're gone. Right, so we did research on the theme of belonging. It was very interesting. A lot has been written about it, a lot in terms of how this affects our mental health. However, whilst there's a lot that's been written about belonging in terms of mental health impact, there's very little in terms of useful statistics, that kind of thing. So instead, we're going to talk a little bit about what belonging means to us. Because what we realised off mic in talking it through was how much this can mean different things to different people. And perhaps there's even something about when I say the word belonging, whatever you consider, like the first thing that you visualise that comes to mind may well be the thing that you're lacking, because that's what happened a little bit to us. So for me, you know, when I was thinking about this theme, I was thinking a lot about the experience of feeling like I belong in a city. You know, and right now it's the first day, as of recording this, it's the first day that the shops are reopening. And it's been so lovely to see people milling around. And I'd sort of somewhat forgotten that there were this many people in Birmingham, if that doesn't sound too silly. But I'm just so used to the quiet streets that to see floods of people just sat around, you know, enjoying a bit of sunshine, enjoying the fact they've got more places to grab food from, that kind of thing, with, you know, big bags of shopping, a lot of Selfridges bags. I don't know how people still have money at this point. Clearly some people do. It was just really nice because I realised how much I'd miss that feeling like I'm a Brummy and we're all kind of hustling and doing our thing and commuting around the place.
Yeah, and what an interesting perspective, especially I think for you, well, for us all in different ways, but for you because you live right in the heart of the city. As you said, you know, connected to everybody around you and the hustle and bustle. And when that goes, that's such a huge part of as soon as you step out of your door. So interesting when you think about belonging, that belonging to a community, to a tribe, to a city is kind of what comes into your mind. I love that.
Whereas I think for you, you first mentioned family. And I wonder if that's partly that with the restrictions, you generally see more family members more frequently than I do. And so maybe that's the thing you're feeling the most at the moment.
Yeah, that all I've got is my family. Get me out of here. Get me out of here. I'm a mother. Get me out of here. Get me to the city. Get me in a restaurant. Like, that's where I feel like I belong.
But do you feel like there's also an element of there's been challenging stuff that your family's gone through over the last few months and you've not been able to kind of be around people and, you know, hug and go see your sister in London and that kind of stuff?
So much. And even my family that only live up the road, in Nottingham, which is, you know, 45 minutes to an hour away, to not connect with them. I think it hit me at the beginning. It was always quite hard. And then, you know, different family members did get COVID and, you know, that was quite difficult to not be able to see them. But, you know, we were lucky that they were okay and managed to get through it as hard as it was at the time. But you know what? It really hit me at Easter, because Easter's a time that we'd always go to my dad's and we'd eat. And it's kind of a culturally quite a big time for food and family. And to hear my children really say, why aren't we going to Grandpop's? I really want to go to Grandpop's. Like, forget the fact that they were pressuring me to cook the same level of food that they get when they go to my dad's. That was one thing I was getting sick of. Like, they were showing me up and my culinary skills. But they were like, oh, we just want some food. We want to go and see Grandpa's. Like, why can't we go? You know, it's been so long. So it's not been easy. Where you feel you belong, I think that's the point. My daughters feel that they belong. It's part of their belonging. And when it was missing, I guess we just had to do what we could to have some connection.
It's a complicated time, isn't it, to consider this, because we know that proximity doesn't in itself make belonging. You know, how many people have gone through experiences, you know, whether it's school, whether it's certain workplaces, whether it is to do with family or any groups really, where just because they're around people doesn't mean they feel connected and safe with them. And yet at the moment it feels like we lack much of the opportunities to even try and belong. And the best we can do maybe is to, you know, keep building on the connections we do have. And I think there is an opportunity to feel somewhat connected with what we're going through. You know, whilst we've talked a lot about the idea that we're in the same storm but not in the same boat, you know, we have a similar but different experience, each of us, in the pandemic, there is still some unity in that. There is still some connection, and this is a strange time for all of us.
I think I agree. And I love that. We said that, didn't we? I think we had an episode right back at the beginning of the pandemic. Or was it somebody that said it to us, or one of us found it, or some whatever, that we're all, you know, in the same storm but not in the same boat. Such an amazing way.
I think it was Francesca Melindri.
Yeah,
so
I do.
If people want a treat for their ears, as far as I'm concerned, go listen back to, there's an episode of our special COVID series last year that started in March. And there's an episode where we say that we have a special guest, we don't name them. And it's because it's a surprise guest where we read out an article by the author and then she got in contact with us. So the next week we had her on the pod. And that was one of these, I guess that's a good example, like a special moment of connection and feeling that belonging, even in a time when, you know, when else was I going to meet her? But yeah, something came together and we got to interview her. And, you know, you get to feel a bit like you're more belonging to the human race when people reach out to you that you didn't expect.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you remembered that it was her, because, yeah, that's a great episode and her article is amazing, her poem. What an interesting thing as well for me is, why did I feel more connected and more belonging at the beginning of the pandemic, say through the first 6 months, where the last 6 months have been the hardest? In fact, since Christmas has been the hardest out of it all. And that's when we've seemingly got better. We know that we're coming out a little bit more. There's less restrictions, but yet I felt under more pressure and less connected. But, you know, we're clapping every week. We were for the NHS outside our front door with the whole of the street banging pans and shouting and whistling for everybody. And everybody knows somebody who works in the NHS. And, you know, it just felt, didn't it, almost like we're going through the worst time ever, but we found all these amazing ways to feel belonging and connected. And how interesting that as we're starting to come out and things are getting a bit better, that sense of belonging is less. It's becoming less for me and for lots of people that I've been speaking to.
It's strange that, isn't it? And I think a big part of it is that our experiences are diverging from each other. That back in those very early days, it felt like we were more in the same boat, right? That we were all dealing with these unprecedented measures. We weren't yet sick of the word unprecedented. And as time's gone on, people have reacted in different ways. People have been affected in different ways. And so our experiences of the pandemic have shifted, and our experiences as people have got further apart again. And so, like we said many times in the early days, I hope we can keep some elements of that connection, you know, even if it's just shared history, like something that we've all gone through. And so we should talk about our guests. There's one quick thing that I wanted to mention actually before it that comes up in the episode, and I just wanted to say a little bit more on, because we talk a fair bit about feeling accepted by yourself or feeling accepted by people around you and the kind of pressures we can all experience to be a certain way, and to whether that's to conform or whether that's to behave a certain way that you're expected to behave, right? And it really got me thinking after the interview about how well confidence cuts through that and makes or breaks it. And it's been a big part of my experience around having an eating disorder, trying to find ways to actually like myself and survive that experience, partly through growing in confidence and self-acceptance, and you make it harder to believe that there is things inherently wrong with me internally or externally. And, you know, confidence has been something that I've worked on and has been so transformative in that. And one example that comes to mind is, you know, even things that are completely out of our control, the way we feel about them can dictate so strongly at times how other people react. So, for example, I'm tall and I'm male, and generally, as a combination, people like that. It's pitched to us by our media and modelling standards and all sorts that being tall and male is good. And yet, there were times when, because I was insecure, I would carry myself differently. I felt too big for the space. I felt clunky. I didn't like towering over people. I didn't like standing out. And not only did it make me look uncomfortable because my posture wasn't as good as it, I've had to relearn it to be now, it also makes other people uncomfortable when you are. You know, people can feel it, and sometimes it can make them feel the same way and they want to stamp it out. And it's funny how something that's as subjective as height, ultimately, the biggest difference for me has been building my confidence. And now people love my height. Even like if I'm towering over somebody, people find it cool or novel or whatever. Whereas when I was just emitting insecurity about this thing, it meant that other people felt uncomfortable too. Hopefully that makes sense within the context I've talked about it. But when you listen to the episode, you'll hopefully draw more of the lines.
Yeah, it does make sense. Thanks for sharing that, because it always makes me think of my little girl who's so tall for her age, and I just love it and want her to always own it and think about her being in spaces where there are other tall people, sport generally being one of them, so she feels comfortable. But like you said, wherever you are, when you are confident with you, it wouldn't matter the spaces that you're in if everybody else was 5 foot and you were 6 foot, because you found something within you that overrides that. You know,
because I think we've all come across those people where they're so confident, they just like they change the bar. They like move the needle almost. And I notice it in my day to day life. Right. Like I've noticed it when someone walks into a room that has bright hair. And if they do it confidently, people are like, oh, wow, I love your hair. It's so incredible. They just get all these compliments. I wonder if that would be the same, if the same person came in really shy and insecure. And like, you know, patting down their hair and trying to make it smaller. Maybe people wouldn't draw attention to it. Maybe people wouldn't say anything. I wonder.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And when we think about our guest today, actually, and talking about confidence with men, you know, how interesting as well that the real test is when you put yourself and you know who you are and you love yourself and begin to kind of take that time to, you know, be connected with who you are. You can be anywhere. And that never leaves you. It's with you all the time. It's your human experience that will stay with you within, regardless of what other people do or say or what environments you find yourself in. And that's truly powerful.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Preach, sister. That's what you're thinking, aren't you?
I'm taking it in. But yeah, we should talk about our guest because he's a wonderful fellow podcaster, also fellow coach for you, and a writer from London. So the listeners may know him from the Mostly Lit podcast that started in 2016, or his more recent show called Time to Talk, which he has just written a book of the same name, all about much of the themes we'll cover in today's episode. So it was a really good chance to catch up with him, someone that's been very active in the mental health space, was so insightful, so articulate, really got us thinking, you know, a lot of angles on this topic that we wanted to cover and a lot that we'd not even considered. So with all that said, we'll get into this interview with the wonderful Alex Holmes in a moment. It is worth me just mentioning that from the start of the interview, there is some discussion around suicide. So just something to bear in mind. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. It's great to be partnering again with Wild, the natural deodorant company, whose products we've been using for a few months now.
They've created a sustainable deodorant that really works. You just buy one aluminium case that lasts a lifetime and holds biodegradable deodorant refills. You can even personalise the case to really make it your own.
And the unisex scents include Orange Zest, Lavender Haze, and regular limited edition specials. The latest one being Lemon Meringue, which I just purchased an extra of because it smells so yummy.
Most of us stick with one deodorant for life, even though it may not be the best fit. This one has a 100% satisfaction guarantee, so it's as risk-free as life gets. Plus, as one of our listeners, you'll get 20% off by using the code MENTAL.
So join us today in going wild for natural deodorant at wearewild.com with code MENTAL at checkout. It's sustainable, effective, discounted, and linked in the episode description. This is a limited time offer, so get wild for your pits today.
Love that.
So my name's Alex Holmes, and one of my early experiences with kind of understanding or, you know, hearing about mental health was when a family friend, and these are black families, so everybody's just intertwined in family anyway, but one of my auntie's daughters died by suicide, and I was around, in my mind, I want to say 15, but I'm not 100% sure, but I was definitely in my teens. And at that age, you're always considering, for me anyway, I was always considering death. I was always considering what that was like. And growing up Christian as a child, I always feared that moment when death arrives when I was younger. But to think about somebody taking their life kind of to ease the suffering and pain that they were having while living was quite traumatizing. I kept envisaging the crash of her falling and what that entailed. I was thinking, how are we navigating this? But for me, I think what was irritating and quite jarring from what I can think back on is the conversations around it. It was this taboo, like nobody really spoke about what was going on. It was just, oh, this person did this. And it was just awkward. It was just awkward, and nobody wanted to open up those conversations. I didn't feel comfortable asking what suicide was. I didn't feel comfortable asking why. And it was just a strange moment that kind of lingered with me for a while. Even going around to her family, it was, yes, somebody had died, but it was kind of acted as if it was just a regular death, which it kind of, you know, we need to kind of take the stigma away from it being kind of looked at as a huge difference, because death is sad. But when it's somebody who is pretty young and they take their life, I feel like there needs to be conversations around it, because then you can kind of start to manage that understanding of what it means. So yeah, that was one of the earliest experiences of hearing a mental health topic when I was younger. But still thinking back, there weren't many conversations around mental health at school. There weren't conversations around mental health in my home, even though I've got an uncle who's schizophrenic. And, you know, knowing now, as somebody who, you know, is quite aware of these things and looking at depression, anxiety, I see people with particular mental health issues in my family. And it just makes me think, what was it like for them to not have the language to be able to discuss this? Yeah, that was one of my real early experiences.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I can just only imagine what that must have been like to experience. And it's strange, even when we look back on these things with the knowledge we now have, they still don't really make much sense. Particularly death by suicide, it's not for lack of there being questions. You know, I can only explain it in terms of the stigma, right? And the lack of, I guess at times it's lack of practice around those kind of conversations. But I'm sure so many people were in that environment as well as you, wondering what happened, having questions about what suicide means, having questions about what could we have done, what brought them to that place in their mind.
Yeah, they did, especially within the family. It was tricky. It was very tricky. And I think even still kind of going around to some, we still keep in contact with the family today. Even still going around, we see pictures of her up, but it doesn't seem like there's many conversations there at all about it. And even now, even with all the work that I do and the things that I talk about on a daily, and obviously the book, it's like, I still feel that weird awkwardness of mentioning suicide. I mean, I have to keep pushing through it because I know that it's more learned behavior than it is anything else. But I keep trying to push through that and just raise awareness of these kind of things. You know, my dad had a cousin who died, and he was in his 50s, you know, died by himself in his home. And it's only then that they start to sit down and kind of engage with these kind of conversations after a long time. And I was just like, these are things that they're not new. Things. These are patterns that over time have kind of led this person to this result. It just kind of makes you sit down, and for me, it makes me think about what are we doing, especially in the Black community, what are we doing as a community to speak about these issues and to really kind of sit down, but as men as well, to sit down and really talk about what's going on.
Right. And a real concern I have about these conversations not existing is that one of the fallouts of that is it can be very othering. So even though these are people that are close to you, it can enforce this mentality that this doesn't happen to us. This is an issue that affects other people. And you kind of perpetuate that when you don't talk about the places in which it does affect your family.
No, you're right. You're right. Ignoring it until it happens and then ignoring it while it happens is just bizarre to me. It's bizarre. Yeah, you're right in that. You're right in that. It is a weird othering. It is a weird othering. I guess it's more of a generational thing as well. It's us as a generation being able to bring the language forward, destigmatize what is going on there. And really, I just literally had a conversation with my aunt about her, you know, probably potentially getting mental health training for her work, because she's a manager. And I was just like, you know, would you potentially look at that? You know, you're trying to take on all of these people's worries and stuff, and then you're kind of carrying this, and then you're kind of, and then you're spread, and then you're making it a part of your life as well. And then you're bringing that home, and then that's affecting people at home and stuff. And then these are how these things happen, because we're not versed in having these conversations and really talking about what's going on and being able to have the tools in order for us to then navigate what people are going through. We still need to do some course correction on language. We still need to do some course correction on how we view people who have mental illness as well. Like, you know, whenever somebody mentions bipolar, people tend to go grey-faced, ashen. And I'm just like, you know, as if it's going to impact the way that they do their work. And, you know, I've had loads of these conversations. I've got friends, they don't like to tell anybody, because then it just becomes this thing that they do, that they are, and it's not helpful to them, and they're trying to just kind of live an ordinary life, just an everyday life, just to try and get through it each day. It's difficult.
Right, and it can be so limiting when somebody labels you in that way. They take something that is already really difficult to deal with and somehow stigmatize around that, oh, you're also going to be deficient in these other areas. This is going to affect your work. I don't know how to talk to this person anymore. I don't know how to have these conversations. There's all these other ways where that experience can be made harder for somebody.
Yeah.
And to zoom back a little bit on your own experience, do you mind sharing a bit about, from that young age, being around particularly the lack of conversation, where did your personal understanding begin to bloom?
I really can't remember even uttering the words mental health until I was like in my 20s. So a good 10 years really after that incident happened. My uncle worked as a forensic psychologist. We did have conversations. I remember him talking to me about Freud and things of that nature, which was interesting to me. But I didn't really kind of marry the two together. I didn't kind of make the links I needed to make. I always grew up interested in dream interpretation and behaviors. I always read about body language and what I could, you know, and just trying to understand what's said when things are unsaid. But I didn't really have much of an understanding of mental health until I got to uni in around 2011-12, where a few of my friends, you know, one of my friends started talking openly about her depression, because she was a poet. In her poem, she spoke about depression, and she spoke about suicidal thoughts, and she spoke about suicide. And then I started hearing it more. I started hearing more conversations, more real life stories, more real examples of people who have gone through these kind of things and these experiences. And then it just became a thing where I just started questioning my own sort of mental well-being. I started reading up a lot more around psychology. Started reading up more around, you know, the term mental health, and started looking into different things. But then my mental health really became a huge factor in my life when I started working as a journalist, and it was a super intense place to be, super intense place to work. And I had my first panic attack while I was there, and it really shook me to the core, to the point where I couldn't move, I couldn't do anything, and I felt like I was going to die. Like, literally, I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel protected. I didn't feel anything. I just felt scared. And so my friend told me to calm down and really got me to start breathing slowly and kind of got me to recognize what was going on around me, to kind of reground me and resurface me back to where I was. And then I had two more panic attacks while at work. And I realized that it was time for me to go to therapy and sit down and really kind of like assess all of the stuff that I was kind of carrying and not speaking about, all the things I was holding, all the traumas that I had seen. So I realized that I'd been grieving a lot just throughout life, losing grandparents, losing aunts, losing uncles, obviously my family friend who passed in that way, and just kind of a lot of, and so many different huge emotional things I was carrying. And I didn't realize how much it was affecting me just on a day-to-day basis. It affected the way I saw myself, affected elements of self-worth, understanding, belonging, being, just all of this stuff, all the things that I thought, you know, kind of carry. I used to carry this badge of the empath with around me and used to be like, oh, I'm empathetic. I understand what people are going through. I feel what they're feeling and all this different stuff. And I'm just like, that is, over time, I recognized the trauma response that that is. It's that, you know, you absorb all of that in the room because you know the kind of energy that it causes in a room when these things aren't addressed. So you absorb all of that and you become the person who starts to kind of give the advice, to console, to pacify, to bring peace, to keep the peace, to do all that stuff. And then you take that outside of the home and you bring it into friendships, you bring it into work, you bring it into all your personal relationships. You absorb all of that stuff because you are boundaryless and you have poor emotional regulation and all of those things. So it was a huge learning. It was a huge curve for me to really sit down and say, this is where I'm at and I want to get better. And I want to get better at managing and becoming more resilient when it comes to the hard stuff, when it comes to grief, when it comes to, you know, disappointing results, having too many expectations, dealing with people who, you know, probably who easily misunderstand you, or, you know, I mean, just kind of really getting to grips with all of that stuff and understanding that it wasn't me, that it doesn't reflect me. It's more of me trying to really kind of relate to people in a way that can help me to survive and move forward and move through all of this.
You've articulated that so perfectly, sharing the response to stressful and turbulent environments where you sort of learn to soak up everything in the room and find ways to constantly like preempt any kind of disagreement, any kind of awkwardness. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, with what you mentioned in terms of a fascination in body language, if that was even part of it. It was almost you trying to learn to draw out of people communication. You were almost taking on their responsibility even for communicating.
Yeah, it's like I was trying to... Like I was trying to say, I need to be able to read between the lines so I don't get caught out, be able just to be one step ahead. Because in my mind at the time, when I was around 20, I was always feeling like I was misunderstood. I was over-explaining myself. I was always, you know, trying to prove myself to someone about something, felt like I was not heard. All these different things that were just experiences from when I was younger and, like, you know, I mean, kind of manifesting in my adult self. Not to get too psychobabble, but the inner child screaming out, this is kind of what we need. We need this attention. We need that and stuff.
But I think that's a very common experience as part of that, right? Because we can look at the kind of protection response, I would describe it as, that you've experienced, whereby you've done all these things. You've built all these skills to look after everyone else and understand everyone else constantly. But what you're not learning on that is where you fit in it. Because you only fit if you're holding somebody else up or you're diffusing tension. So where are you if you're only ever a mirror to improve other people's lives?
Exactly. Exactly. Who are you at the end of the day without all of that stuff?
And whilst you're building up all those skills, you're not building up the skills of building those two-way connections where people get to understand you better.
And, you know, in some ways, that's the art of growing up, isn't it? It takes longer for some. And it's quicker for others. Everybody does it in their way, in how they're supposed to do it. Some people don't get to this revelation or this understanding until they're much older. Several relationships in, several conversations, several battles, several fights. You know, everybody's on that kind of path to understanding when it makes sense for them. That's the level of compassion you need to have with a lot of people, because you know, when we start to push and say, you know, you should be doing this quickly, you should be doing it, you should be here, you should be all of that stuff, it just becomes very difficult to, for people to, you know, for people to really trust the process of what's happening, the experiences they need to experience, the things they need to learn, the people they need to encounter in order for them to learn stuff. So, yeah.
And so you were going to share then with the grief you were carrying around and the unprocessed and uncommunicated feelings, how gender played a role in that as well.
Yeah, because on top of all of that, like, it's a huge reason. The whole boys don't cry thing, the whole boys shouldn't do X, boys shouldn't do Y, leaves you with very little at the end of the day emotionally, because you are just made to feel as if you're meant to be this kind of shell of a man, the shell of a person. You know, you just this snail scooped out of the shell, and then they just give you the shell, and you done that's kind of all you've got, really. And it just felt like you couldn't express when you were upset. You couldn't express when people pissed you off, or when people kind of, like, you know, really kind of got you riled up to a point where you can't really express. Like, my default was to cry, like, was to kind of, like, get so pent up. I'll just be, like, angry, but, like, teary. And that wasn't accepted. That wasn't acceptable, because other people were projecting their stuff onto me. It's difficult, because now when you start to look around and you think to yourself, as an adult now, I cry all the time. I cry watching films. I'm a super emotional guy. Like, and I'm happy, and I'm clear, and I'm cool to talk about it and say it, and that's what I do. But when I look at, like, the older generation or other guys in, like, in my age group even, they really struggle with that. But I don't really like saying, oh, you know, you just have to cry. It's something that you have to do. But it's the understanding to say that it's okay for you to do that. Yeah, like, I look around at a lot of people and I just think, look how much a part of you is lost, because you can't experience the full breadth of human emotion. If all you can experience is anger and aggression, where does that leave for all of the other stuff? I remember being in year 12 and we were taking pictures, like, you know, you're 17, 18, everyone's starting to do selfies now and everyone's taking photos of each other and we're kind of really collecting those memories. And, you know, they were really joyous times. And I remember smiling, like, just wide-toothed, I always smiled. And then there's one Ghanaian guy in my class and he was just like, oh, my uncle always said, guys, men don't smile in photos. I was like, what's the point of being in a photo if you're not going to smile? Like, what do you mean? Like, why? It's really sad, because I know a part of him has been lost to that, you know, really lost to that. Like, he won't smile in photos. And there will be a day, probably has come, where, you know, if he has a child or a son or daughter, they'll be asking, why aren't you smiling in these photos? Or he'll tell them, don't smile in photos. All these learned patterns, all these things that we just push aside and, like, you know, really killing us, simply because of all these learned behaviors. As guys, when you are told that you shouldn't be doing X, Y, and Z, you're going to take that with you. And that's the sad thing. So my whole thing is to give guys permission to be able to do it. That doesn't mean that they, I'm not going to say you should or shouldn't do anything.
Cry now.
Have permission. Cry now. Yeah, I want people to feel like they have permission to do that and take ownership of that as well.
I know what you mean. I think that's so true. And what I've been thinking about lately is how this specific element of stigma creates an environment where we feel the need to have an excuse. It becomes like a race to the bottom, where those that are quote unquote doing well at masculinity are fitting these narrow stereotypes of what it is to be male. They are losing. Even if you win at masculinity, you still lose because you can't cry, you can't do other things. And absolutely, I've heard people say, yeah, you can't smile, you can't be seen to have, you know, too much fun. Like, it's crazy when you realize how much is ruled out. And there's these layers of it where maybe people wouldn't be as surprised if I cry as a mental health podcaster, or as someone that tends to present in a more androgynous way in my appearance. Somehow I get more of a pass than someone that's somehow meeting more of the stereotypes of masculinity. Like, that's the thing that's been blowing my mind about it lately, as I try and unpick this stuff of the people that are winning at masculinity are the ones that are actually losing, because they're most bound up in it.
Because what are you winning? what is the prize?
Yeah, because it's like perceived acceptance. It's not even real. Doesn't mean people actually like you. If anything, it just means people are less likely to notice you. You just blend in.
Right. this validation from everybody else but yourself means that who are you even in the space then? If everything is just a performance, then what happens when the curtains come down? Who are you, you know, outside of all of that? I do find that really tricky. And that's why I had to really kind of get to grips and really sit down and study a lot of this stuff and really look around and explore my understanding around masculinity. That I've just come to terms with the fact that it needs to expand. We've just been kind of going down this really narrow, muddied path that doesn't really serve anybody at the end of the day, you know? So people who are more androgynous in appearance, people who more quote-unquote masculine looking, people who are more femme looking, people who express in completely different ways, it doesn't make them any less of a man. It just makes them a man who expresses this way. Because the policing needs to stop, yeah. Because the police, men police each other the most. It needs to stop.
For sure. And the secret that I've learned about it is that really, when you step outside of it, people don't care nearly as much as you perceive they will. You know, there's all this expectation that's built up over time. All the little things you hear, like you've mentioned, men don't cry, and all these kind of rules that get soaked up into us that can make you feel like, I am doomed. I'm going to be exiled if I don't follow all of these rules. And then I don't think any man feels they are following all the rules anyway. So then we're all doomed, even if we are trying to fit them. You know, it's such a weird thing. And, you know, I can speak from my own experience on that, where nobody really cares how I present because I'm confident. That's the thing. And yet I've had to really work on that for something that really doesn't matter anyway. But it's incredible how, when you step outside of it, it's the uncomfortability that I think a lot of guys are scared of. So if I felt very insecure about my appearance, that would make other men feel uncomfortable, and people in general. And I think part of that is that when we can relate to negative feelings, we can feel them in ourselves. You know, that resonates with us, and then we want to push it down, or we want to tell somebody to act differently. But if they're confident with it, you know, look at celebrities that dress however the fuck they want, you know?
Yeah, they're adoring fans everywhere, and they've got the privilege of celebrity, right? So to an extent, if they are physically attacked, there is a outcry, in a sense, whereas the regular person has to think about their security as well. And I do hear what you're saying. Yeah, definitely. In writing the book as well, and just really looking at it, it's just so many men lose. We never think about what we lose in this space. You know, we lose so much. On my Instagram, I do little musings as well as some interesting reels every so often. I just really started getting into reels. They're really fun. But yeah, like I said something, and I wrote this, wishing to be a real man is a waste of energy, because you are a man and that makes you real. And this whole idea of that there's this standard, and there's this idea that you of what you have to be, it's doing so much damage.
Yeah. And I always like to come at these things from like a random third perspective when I can, because I think it helps illuminate how made up it all is. Because there's so much that actually isn't real, but enough of us believe in it, and that makes it real. Like, one example I've been thinking about recently is borders. The wildlife, they don't know what's a border, but because enough people believe in it, and because of the history around these things, it creates such meaning. And yet, to every other species, the border doesn't exist. Unless there's water, it doesn't really exist.
Yeah. It's all this, it's all made up. It's all made up. By men, no less. It's all made up, though. So yeah, I just think, you know what, like, I know nothing will change overnight, but I also just think that at least we can have the conversations to kind of start to really understand that the reality that we live in, we can make it whatever we want to make it.
And so one thing you mentioned earlier that I want to talk about further is the idea of like accepting yourself and, you know, our theme of belonging. I'm interested in the idea of belonging to yourself versus belonging within a culture or a gender or a whatever else.
I found out quite early that we betray ourselves quite a lot as men, as people, to be honest, but we betray ourselves a lot. We cross our own boundaries. We don't put ourselves in a position of safety or security a lot of the time for the sake of other people, for the sake of, as we mentioned earlier, that sake of acceptance and wanting to be liked and all of these other things. when we don't belong to ourselves first, we betray ourselves. We're betraying who we are. We're betraying our thinking. We're betraying our thoughts. We're betraying our feelings. We're putting all of that aside because of this feeling that we've been given to serve other people and not ourselves. That's just it being stripped down, stripped right back before you even kind of get to, you know, gender identity, sexual identity, political identity, all of this different stuff, your history, your family, all of that. Before you even get there, there's so many people who grow up believing so many things about themselves and so many things about the community and their culture. And then they get to a point where they just really sit back and think, hold on, wait, what? My whole world is flipped upside down now because I have this experience, this new experience and this new understanding of stuff. And when we don't feel like we belong, we become lonely. And when we become lonely, that's when we start to, that's when all of the things start to happen. That's when all of the negative self-talk, the feelings of disconnection from your family, from your community, from your friends, etc. We start to feel all of that. And that's kind of where I look at belonging, especially in the book. But that's kind of where I tend to look at where belonging came from, in understanding that until we really understand how to belong to ourselves and not abandon ourselves for the sake of other people, the loneliness epidemic is going to continue to grow. A lot of it really comes from how we view ourselves and what we view about ourselves and what we think about ourselves too.
Yeah, and I think it can be so easy to do these things, to not accept ourselves, and goes back to that I was mentioning earlier, the idea of othering. And we can very much other ourselves, and we live in a culture that encourages that in many ways, you know, with all these rules like we've mentioned about what it is to be your gender. But also, how many times do people think about, oh, I'll like my body when I'm this weight, or I hate how I look, but when I get a haircut, I'll like myself again. And, you know, all these ways where this is backed up by some of the shallowness and the over rule creating, the over government of, well, you called it policing, the over policing is a good term, of how we all behave and what we have to do to be acceptable. It can be so easy to buy into that because it's everywhere. And then we end up othering ourselves. If that's the rules you're going by, when will you ever accept yourself? Because there is no perfect body. There is no perfect gender presentation. There's no perfect mental health. There's no perfect job. So what?
Acceptance is a huge, huge thing. And actually understanding perfection doesn't exist. So when we understand that, I feel like that's what really matters, you know? Not everybody's going to be perfect. I mean, I feel like it's just, like somebody mentioned this week about, you know, that somebody must have put a post on Instagram about parenting, about how we have to self-parent ourselves as we grow older, and about the inner child, sorry. And then somebody must have mentioned that it's about good parenting. That's why you need good parenting and stuff. And I was just like, there isn't any good or bad parenting. There's just people who know more about themselves and what they pass on to their children, and people who don't. There's those who do and there's those who don't. Like, objectively, obviously there's good and bad parenting from the standard that you expect, but I would believe that everybody is trying to do the best with whatever tools they have and whatever they know, you know. And that's where I think like a lot of acceptance comes from too. Because when you actually sit down and you say, okay, my dad didn't, you know, he wasn't tactile. He wasn't the person that I could go to for emotional stuff. When you hold on to that kind of stuff as like a grudge and something that you're holding them to task for things that they have no control over themselves, you know, in some ways, there's about coming to an understanding of that. They did as much as they could do with the tools and the resources that they had inside them. A lot of people look at that and they say, you know, well, they could have done better. They could have done this. They could have done that. And yeah, very well, they could have. But what is that doing for me and my own kind of journey and my own growth? You know, holding somebody to task for things that they couldn't see, but that you can now, but that they couldn't. When we start to really understand that we're all on this journey and we're all trying to understand it, ourselves, it becomes, things become a lot clearer. And that's when you have to start doing the work yourself to really kind of figure out what is going on with you and figure out what you do. Whether that means you have to take a step back, whether that means you have to set your boundaries, whether that means you alter your relationship with them, whether that means, you know, because I don't doubt that people, some people would have gone through serious abuse and gone through some serious experiences. But it's taking control and taking agency of that again and being able to really understand the steps that you've got to take in order for you to feel safe, for you to feel protected, but also for you to address the stuff that's going on and accept what's happened. And I think a lot of our pain comes from the fact that we don't accept a lot of stuff, as well as, you know, and then that leads into the feelings of not belonging and, you know, not lack of forgiveness, and you're disconnected. And we see a lot of that, and it's kind of spread around because then they meet other people and they pass their stuff on, and people get trauma bonds, and they bond through via that. And then it's just like, you know, and the system and the cycles continue. And it's like,
right. And I think that really links to belonging in terms of belonging amongst others as well. There comes many points through our lives where we have to find our tribe, find our people. Mm-hmm. And that is very much a part of growing up, you know, that the default people we belong to are our parents initially. And for some people, that doesn't work out early on. For some people, it does. But ultimately, we still have to find belonging in other places. And taking ownership of what we need, I think, is a big part of that. And also what kind of safety we're searching for.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Because I think about so often when people build up the communities around them that matter most, it often is around particular types of support, you know, or particular topics or shared history, shared culture. And there's such a bond that can come from that. You know, maybe it's just a bit less to explain. Maybe it's a bit of understanding that you've not had to earn. And do you feel like that's something then that you particularly sought out, that as you work to understand how to explain yourself to people and how to connect easier, you found there were certain people that could do that so much easier?
Finding your community is important. I always say when we have our relationships, we should be learning from them. We should be learning from the people that are around, gaining that level of wisdom, that understanding. Yes, you want to be understood, unless you want people to understand your pain and your experiences as well. And again, this just comes with maturity and time as well. But I remember going through like a period of just like meeting, having, making so many new friends, because I was really trying to just find my tribe and find the people. A lot of it just didn't work. Like, it just kind of, like, some of the friendship just ended. I was in groups I didn't want to be in. And, you know, I mean, it was just kind of a lot of different stuff. But I've still got loads of, like, love for a lot of people. But I just had to take a step back and say, actually, I didn't even have that level of belonging in me. I didn't even have that. I was jumping around from this group to that group to this relationship to that relationship. I was going here, there, wherever. Because I didn't want to sit with myself and really understand what I was doing. And I'm all about, my whole thing is about showing up for your friends and showing up in the space and showing up for yourself and your family and being able to be who you need to be to support them, you know, and for them, and to know what you need from them for them to support you. And try not to roll into these places with too much expectation and too many things, because it's very unlikely that it will kind of pan out for you in the end, as my early friendships really kind of just fizzled and exited with a bang in some places.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's such a good way that you've linked there, the seeking like belonging and acceptance within yourself being integral to feeling that elsewhere. And the clearest example that I have of that is within the modelling world, where I used to, with the agency I'm signed to, I used to be involved in training the models. And so many of them came in for reasons that were quite concerning. One of the common reasons people try and get into that industry is they're looking for confidence via validation. That if I go into this and I get to be all dressed up and photographed beautifully, then maybe this something, this little spark of maybe I'm worth something might really ignite. But the catch of it is, and the thing that's quite heartbreaking to watch when, you know, I would often realise this, is if there wasn't a baseline level of confidence there, nothing happened. that any compliment they might have received, any job they booked, any photo that came out well, just felt like compliments on another person because they had no confidence for that to resonate with. And therefore, the stuff that was actually connecting was any job they didn't get, any criticism. This isn't the right size for you. Let me grab a different outfit. You know, right to that extreme where people be like, oh, shit, I'm wrong. Rather than the outfit is the wrong size for you, which happens all the time. And it can be very easy to think, oh, that's something wrong with me, if your confidence isn't to a certain level, particularly in an environment where there is a lot of rejection.
I hear you. And it's so funny. I used to send my stuff to myself. I used to send photos to modeling places, and it literally you just triggered this memory into my mind. It's just like, it was literally there just because I wanted validation. I wanted that validation for people to say, oh my God, you could be a model. You know, my family always said, oh, you're handsome. You could, dress this way and did it. You know, family say that. And I was like, yeah. But you're not the kind of people I'm trying to attract. You know what I mean? Just move. Like, you know what I mean? They can say I'm handsome. That's your job. You're supposed to do that. But I wanted that validation from like a photographer to be like, you've got it. You've got that. Bang, bang, sort of stuff. And then over time, I just kind of really just started looking at, you know, no, like responses were like kind of low. And I was like, ugh, should I do it? Do I even want to do this? Went into acting for a bit. I love the creation of the drama, not necessarily being the drama sort of thing. And it's just like all of these different stuff that I did a lot of performing arts. I was kind of center stage for a lot of things. And I do love public speaking. So that was kind of what I kind of like. I like to share a message and share an idea and share those things publicly once I'm aware, once I know what I'm saying, once I know what I'm talking about. And that's kind of, and that all kind of manifested in wanting to be seen and wanting to be heard and wanting to feel value. So what you said was actually really interesting, because when people do go into those spaces, like the most successful people, from my sister works in fashion and she does all that stuff. And when she's kind of like pointing people out in the street, she's like, oh, that person could be a model. Da, 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 da. They're the ones that aren't even looking for that. They're just like, oh, okay. Well, that's cool then. Let's try it. And then they kind of just enter into that space. And I think that's kind of just, and you know, like when we start to seek this validation from other people again, you know, it's like, is my body okay? Is my face okay? Is my lips too big? Is my nose too big? Is my head the right shape? You can't do anything about your head shape. So you start to overanalyze every element and every part of you and start to edit yourself. And then that's a very rocky road to go down. And you know this as somebody who works in that space, and you've probably seen it quite often.
Yeah, and I think that's really the key that you've highlighted there, that this stuff is so common and so constant that imagine the connection we could all have if the conversations happened more, if more of us were admitting to these insecurities and finding connection in not having it all figured out, you know, as opposed to feeling that we need to be somehow this perfect version of ourselves in order to be accepted and successful and loved. If instead we could realize more that we're all trying to figure this out, and actually that's a much easier thing to connect on. That's the thing that we all have in common. Life
is, I know what we're doing.
Yeah, life is weird and strange and hard, and we're doing our best. And surely we all have that in common.
Yeah. And seeing that and meeting as many people as I've met, and I still want to meet so many more. And having these conversations and having a wide variety of friends and having a wide variety of conversations in spaces like this, you know, and just continuing to do that just enhances the human experience, because I learn so much from all of this stuff, and rather than being so narrowed and confined. So, yeah.
What a great place to round up then. So thank you so much for sharing your perspective. If people want to hear more from you, they can obviously follow your Instagram. You are at...
I'm on Instagram at by Alex Holmes. So that's BY Alex Holmes.
And you've also got the book, Time to Talk. And the tagline for that is How Men Think About Love, Belonging and Connection. And so I would describe that as a really accessible exploration into much of what we've talked about in terms of connection. And whilst it is targeted at men, I think there's a lot that we can all learn from it. And you describe it as a love letter to all the men who have lost their way and to the women that love them.
Yeah. And the podcast, Time to Talk with Alex Holmes, is where I just host the conversations as well. So, yeah, just tap into those.
Yeah, see, you're not making it up. When you say about having conversations with different people and understanding different perspectives, you are doing the work, and a lot of it fed into this great book. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
And thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, no worries. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.